The greatest trick of all is what happens inside our minds. Moviegoers crave the illusion of another world. From time to time, we need to imagine that we can inhabit a different reality, a cosmos of beautiful people, dramatic events, times different from our own. Through wars, stock market crashes, and alternate forms of entertainment, people have continued to attend movies in large numbers. When television first appeared in the 1950s, the prophets thought it would replace the movies. It did not. Similarly, when home video appeared in the 1970s, the prophets thought it would replace the movies. It did not. Likewise for DVDs in the 1990s. Evidently, there is something about an evening out of the house, about watching a story unfold in the dark while surrounded by a crowd of strangers that cannot be replaced. Could M.A. have foreseen so much back in 1915 as he looked out of his hotel window at people lining up in front of a ramshackle store? Did he know that he would become a magician? I remember the years during my early adolescence when I sat in the balcony section of the old Malco on Main and Beale and watched movies. I saw maybe two or three movies per week, sometimes three movies in a single day. In the cool dark of the balcony, the movies became my alternate reality, tilting and stretching my mind. And when I left the theater, entering the other reality, I began imagining that I could set scenes. I could bring in a backdrop here or there. I could position people around me. I could change the camera angle from sideways to overhead. I began seeing life as a series of scenes.
Privilege and glamour figure very prominently in your memoir. It begins with a death in the family, and even that description has style as a component. You write about your uncle Ed, the most debonair of the clan, succumbed at age 95 with a half glass of Johnny Walker on his bedside table. Tell us, how did your relatives become some of the most important, influential business, civic, and cultural leaders in Memphis?
Well, it started with my grandfather, M.A. Lightman, who moved to Memphis in 1929 with his wife and three children, one of the children being my father. And he had already started in the movie business in 1915 when there were still silent movies. And he was a figure larger than life. And he got to know some of the movie stars in Hollywood. And he was so handsome himself that people thought he was a movie star. He had charisma. And he created a movie theater empire that eventually had 60 movie theaters in five or six different states.
It was not only bringing the films into people's lives, he had quite a flair for showmanship with presenting live entertainment in the theater, which your dad carried on.
Well, in the early days of the movies, there was always live entertainment. There would be some kind of an act on stage, like vaudeville, that would precede the film. That was the way the transition was made between live theater and film, was by combining the two. My grandfather, M.A. Lightman, was also an amateur actor and liked to ham around. And maybe that theatrical quality in his personality was what drew him to the movie business in the first place.
And the competitive spirit, I mean, the self-confidence he had. Yep. You say that for your grandfather, the game of bridge was a blood sport.
Well, he was a fierce bridge player, extremely competitive. And at his peak in the 1940s and maybe early 50s, he was one of the four or five best bridge players in the country. He played with all of the great bridge players like Gorin and other people. I didn't know about all of his exploits when I was when he was alive. I was just 10 years old when he died, but I did have a a sense of his personal power.
And in fact, you address that in your sections on the Phasma, and you refer to the Kabbalah, all because of this larger-than-life character who was responsible for your father's life and your life. Would you talk about that?
Yeah, the book has a little bit of magic realism in it. In order to capture the power of this man, I created a sort of ghost, which I call the Phasma, P-H-A-S-M-A. That's just a term that I made up, which is a spirit that is created by a powerful person, and the spirit can be reborn in other bodies. It can go backwards in time and affect events even before the birth of the creator. I attribute to that Phasma many of the deeds and actions and effects that M.A. had on people. He certainly had tremendous effects on his children and his grandchildren. My father lived completely within his shadow. I think my father was partly destroyed by M.A.
You discovered a 1930 issue of Film and Radio Review that had a feature on your grandfather, and you said he had two strikes against him. He was a Southerner and a Jew. I mean, these two identities, I think, are profoundly fascinating, and I was hoping you would talk about that.
I talked about those two strikes against M.A. in the context of his being president of the National Motion Picture Theater Owners Association. And they were speaking about 50 years ago, but I think it's still somewhat true that Southerners are considered ignorant by the rest of the country. So the other members of this National Theater Owners Association of America, who came from all parts of the country, they would have considered M.A. to be ignorant as well. The fact that he was Jewish was another strike against him, just because of the anti-Semitism in the country.
And don't you think he embodied the very idea of, if you can't join them, beat them?
Yeah, I think he was very pragmatic and tried to do whatever was necessary to be successful in business. Although he was very competitive and did do some cruel things to my father, I think that he also was capable of great graciousness and gentility. And he had that Southern charm and courtesy. He also was an honest person. And I think that those various qualities allowed him to overcome the two strikes against him.
My husband and I moved down here to Atlanta 37 years ago, and I had never known Southern Jews. We're Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
And for a Yankee coming down here was kind of difficult to understand the subtlety in language and the understatement, and yet this value system of decency and uprightness. Some of it was difficult for us to understand in terms of the way Southern Jews employed household help and treated household help as other Southern whites did.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you were white living in the South up until probably the 1980s, almost any white family could afford to hire a black maid. And it's so pervasive, it's part of so much a part of society that I think that it transcends religious and social traditions.
Blues on my mind, blues all around my head.
Growing up in the South, as I did, I just took the black help as a given, and it wasn't until many years after I had moved out of the South that I saw that could be exploitative. And I think I became very uneasy with the relationship that my parents and especially my mother had with our black help.
Thought I went to the graveyard, fell down on my knees.
Yeah, that portion you wrote about your mother's treatment of Blanche, your housekeeper, whom you said you and your brothers loved her as a mother.
Like our mother. We loved her as much as our mother.
Was that because she was so affectionate outwardly?
She was very affectionate, and she gave us unconditional love. Part of that unconditionality in her love was just Blanche's own temperament, and part of it was the social separation between us, that she didn't make any demands on us, that she, when we came home from school with problems, she would just listen to them and comfort us, whereas my mother had all of these complicated layers of searching for her own identity, and she always demanded something in return for her love, whereas Blanche demanded nothing.
Your mother was a sad figure in many ways. You wrote that she seemed incapable of experiencing pleasure.
Well, I think she experienced pleasure to some extent, but I think that she never embraced pleasure fully. When she would laugh, it would be kind of a shallow laugh instead of a deep belly laugh. And when she danced, she was a dancer and a dance teacher. It always looked like she was holding back something or forcing herself to move the way that she did.
And yet she found that self-expression and was an early devotee of rock and roll.
Well, on the outskirts of town, there's a little night spot. Dan dropped in about 5 o'clock. Pulled off his coat and said the night is short. He reached in his pocket and he flashed a quart and hollered, "Rave on, children, I'm with you."
What a great city to live in for that. In fact, Memphis isn't just a backdrop. It really feels like a main character in your story. And in addition to the history and places you describe, you evoke Memphis quite vividly in this section titled Heat.
It is a Sunday afternoon, and I am alone in the house I grew up in. When the air conditioner went haywire this morning, my father departed for cooler locations. I remained. I wanted this heat. This heat is the true flesh of the South. It is part of the pace and the manners and the patience I'd forgotten. In physics, heat is motion and speed at the molecular level. But in humanity, and especially Southern humanity, heat is slowness, deliberation, grace, a rounded kind of courtesy. I want to roll in it and taste it. I've stripped down to my undershorts, and the sweat slowly drips down my bare chest and legs. In this heat, an ice cube melts in 3 minutes. The air has a thickness. It's unimaginable that people could work in this heat, and indeed, outdoor construction in Memphis comes to a near halt in June, July, and August. Just a few summers ago, 8 people perished from the heat in Memphis. One of the victims was a 67-year-old woman from New Jersey visiting for the 30th anniversary of Elvis Presley's death. She expired at a recreational vehicle park near Graceland.
Bye bye, baby. Baby, bye bye.
Northerners are unprepared, even though some travel brochures warn that, quote, summer heat is brutal in Memphis, end quote, as it is in Birmingham and Oxford and New Orleans. It could be argued that the main character of Dora Welty's No Place for You, My Love, is not the man or the woman who meet in the restaurant, but the crippling heat of the South. I know that the 20s, 30s, and 40s, that Beale Street had just side by side sharing the pavement were hotels, clubs with music, bars, brothels. People would deliver cocaine by bicycle, heroin by bicycle, and yet new music was being created there. That's where B.B. King hung out. B.B. King was one of the starters of rock and roll.
Now it is 3 o'clock in the morning. Can't even close my eyes.
And he, for a while, was one of the disc jockeys on an all-black radio program called WDIA, which I think started in the 1940s. This was a radio program that played all-black music. It was called race music.
I'm red, yeah. It makes no difference what you think about me. Yeah. And it makes a whole lot of difference what I think about you. Yeah. We should hang out together like hotcakes and molasses. Hey. That's what beans say to comrade. Cause beans and comrade. They...
I think Sun Studio was created around 1950 or so. And Sam Phillips was a white man who listened to all of this black music, this race music. And of course, it had a very limited audience just because of the racism in Memphis, and a lot of whites didn't want to have anything to do with it. And Sam Phillips began thinking that if he could find a white man who could sing black, that he would have the best of both worlds.
Well, it's one for the money, two for the show, three to get ready now, go cat go, but don't you step on my blue suede shoe.
I think somewhere around 1953, the young Elvis walked into Sun Studio with a cheap guitar and played something for Sam Phillips, and Sam realized that was the sound he'd been looking for.
Honey, lay off them shoes and don't you step on my blue suede shoe. Well, you can do anything but take me over my blue suede shoes. Let's go, cat!
Now, the Malco Theater was on Beale, was it not?
Yes, it was on Beale and Main Street on that corner.
And you described it as more 19th century German opera house than movie theater?
Yeah, I mean, it still exists. It's now called the Orpheum. It's not used to show movies anymore, but it is an enormous building, and it does look both outside and inside, mainly inside, like a 19th century German opera house. It has ceilings that go up 50 feet into the air with two or three tiers of balconies, and it seats 2,500 people. And if you lie on the floor looking up, it feels like you're in the Grand Canyon looking up. It has beautiful mosaic tiled floors and the mezzanine and the lobby and crystal chandeliers and curving stairways that lead up to the balcony.
It sounds like it was your grandfather's Versailles.
It was. That was not his first movie theater in Memphis. I think his first movie theater was the Linden Circle, and his second one was the Memphian. The Malco, I think, entered his empire in the early 1940s. I don't know the exact date, but it was something like that.
And that became the flagship.
Yes, and that's where his office was, and the office of his staff.
Now, Elvis used to visit the Malco Theater, and you met him. Would you tell us more about that?
Well, Elvis became friendly with Malco when he was working as an usher at the Lowe's Palace, a competitor which was down the street from Malco, also in downtown Memphis. And during his breaks, he would walk over to the Malco and became friendly with one of the employees of Malco. And through that friendship, became friendly with my grandfather and father. Elvis started making his own movies in the late 50s. I think Love Me Tender was his first movie. It might have been around 1958 or so. And he wanted to see his own movies after they were finished, because he'd probably only see them in the editing stage, if at all. But he wouldn't go to a public movie theater because he would be mobbed. So he went to see his movies at my grandfather's screening room, which was a tiny movie theater connected to my grandfather's house in East Memphis. And his screening room had about 20 seats in it. It had a couch in the front. It had a bar with liquor. It had a little glass cabinet with chocolates and candies inside of it. It had pictures on the wall of my grandfather with various movie stars like Gary Cooper and Greta Garbo. It's about 1960. It was whenever G.I. Blues came out, because that was when Elvis was in the military, made a movie called G.I. Blues, and I think it was around 1961 or 2, somewhere around there. I was about 13 years old, and I didn't really know much about Elvis, even though Elvis was wildly popular.
Yeah, yeah. I got those up, two, three. free for occupation, G.I. Blue. From my G.I. head to the heels of my G.I. shoe.
It wasn't the kind of music that I listened to, and I just didn't know much about him. But I did notice that when he came into the movie theater, he was in his mid-20s at that time. He had two girlfriends with him, one on each arm.
Because he could.
Because he could. And he and his two girlfriends, one on each side of him, sat on the couch in the front of the theater. Although I didn't know much about Elvis, I was extremely impressed that one guy could have two girls. So that's what registered with me. And then later on, I realized that that was Elvis Presley.
You met the king, Alan.
Well, he said you was high class. Well,
I like how you can't resist defaulting to physics for chapter titles, the one for every action and equal and opposite reaction. You write at great length about your mom and dad and what you got from each of them. We talked a bit about your mom. Your father, you said, was an intellectual and an artist, and do you think he was able to thrive within the confines of his father's business, given those talents he had?
He found a way for himself. He focused on the most creative aspects of the business, which were designing advertisements and creating publicity stunts that would go along with the movies, like for a movie called Donosaurus. Built a very large, maybe 20 feet high, papier-mâché dinosaur.
Rampaging in an unsuspecting world, living creatures from the dawn of time. What havoc will they wreak? What lives will they destroy? What depths of panic and terror will they create?
So he found an outlet for his creative talents. He was not a businessman at all. He couldn't balance his own checkbook, never knew how much money he had in the bank, but he did like the creative part of the business. Starting in the, I would say, the 1970s, that aspect of the business was diminished and diminished because the advertisements became more standardized. There were no longer any stunts and publicity theatrical events that went along with the films. And so the part of the business that he enjoyed withered and died from the 1970s on. And I think probably the last 15 years that he worked in the business that he felt that he was bored and just doing routine work.
I should have quit you and went on to Mexico.
Well, among your father's greatest accomplishments was his role in desegregating the movie patrons.
Yes, that was something that he didn't really talk about much himself because he was an extremely modest man. Before the 1960s, of course, everything in the South was segregated. There were different water fountains for blacks and whites, different lunch counters and department stores. Blacks and whites didn't sit on the same section of a bus. The whites sat in front, the blacks sat in back. And in movie theaters, the whites sat in the ground floor and the blacks sat in the balcony. And the blacks had their own entrance into the movie theater that took them straight up to the balcony. And the whites entered the main entrance. The entrance to the blacks was almost like a side door to the movie theater. And around 1962, there were a couple of black men who were members of the National Association of Colored People, the NAACP, and they came to the Malco box office and asked to be seated in the white section, in the regular downstairs section, knowing that that was inflammatory. And my father realized at that time, putting that together with other things that were happening in civil rights in the country in the early 1960s, that it was time to integrate his theaters. So he worked out a scheme with a couple of representatives from the NAACP, as well as with the police department and the fire department of Memphis, very, very discreetly and very quietly. a scheme for slowly integrating his theaters. And the way that he did it was with the first theater was he waited until the middle of the movie when the theater was dark and brought in one black couple and seated them in the white section on the ground floor. And then the next night he brought in two black couples and seated them in the white section while the lights were off. And by the end of a couple of weeks, he was seating 20 or 30 black couples in the white section and did this very slowly over a period of time. An interesting thing about this is that he kept this secret from the mayor of Memphis, Henry Loeb. Henry Loeb was a staunch racist, and my father knew that if Henry Loeb found out that this was going on, that he would put a stop to it immediately. So my father had to work with the police department and the fire department secretly. He needed the cooperation of the police department in case any trouble arose. He also needed the cooperation of the major newspapers of Memphis, the Press-Imeter and the Commercial Appeal, so that they would not write any stories about this until it was totally completed.
As with JFK and Dallas, certainly the tragedy of Martin Luther King's death casts its pall over Memphis. You wrote that you felt extreme personal embarrassment and shame.
Yes. Well, at the time that Martin Luther King was assassinated in 1968, I was attending a Northern college. And I had gone to the North specifically to escape the South because I felt that people from other parts of the country considered Southerners to be ignorant and bigoted and slow, and I didn't want that label attached to me. So I made it a point of getting out of the South. And so I was in my Northern university, it was Princeton, at the time that Martin Luther King was assassinated, and suddenly all of this negative publicity was back on my hometown. You know, I can remember some of my classmates asking me about Memphis because some of them didn't know anything about Memphis at all. They might have heard that Elvis was from Memphis. But Martin Luther King's assassination really put Memphis on the map for many people, and of course in a highly negative way. And so when my classmates would ask me to tell them about Memphis after the assassination, I felt extremely embarrassed. And that's when I vowed that I would not live there ever again.
And you wrote, "This town aches in my flesh. I'll always live here, but I cannot live here." Do you still feel that way?
No, I don't feel that way anymore. It does ache in my flesh, and I love Memphis, and it shaped me. I think the places that I have chosen to live in my later life and my career have not been dictated by geographical regions or social considerations. They've been strictly professional.
You mentioned your professional life as a physicist. There aren't many people whose talents span science and the humanities as yours does. And in the chapter where you wrote about building a rocket, you said that appealed to both your poetic and scientific proclivities. You said, "Finally, you traded certainty for uncertainty, questions with answers, or questions without answers." Having written this memoir, did you in fact discover some answers?
Yeah, I think so. I think I discovered how deep my Southern roots are, for one thing. And I think I've gained some understanding of my relationship with my grandfather and my father. I worshiped my grandfather when I was very young and felt like my father was a weakling. I didn't want to be anything like him. In later life, my feelings about the two have reversed, and I've come to admire my father, but I was never able to really tell him so. I tried to tell him, but I don't think it ever stuck.
You expressed something in a way that I think resonates with so many of us who have lost both parents when you said that you saw your childhood as a vanishing dream connected to the comfort and love of a world safeguarded by parents. Even losing our parents when they're in their 90s, it can be a shock. That resonated so beautifully. I think it will give peace and bring a lot of meaning to those who read about your very personal experience.
Well, I would feel very fortunate and privileged if I could help other people deal with that terrible loss. It's something that we all go through, and we all have felt it.
Alan Lightman, it really has been a privilege to talk with you.
Thank you, Lois.
Me.